Therapy with My Mom is an educational podcast meant to entertain and provide individual perspectives to our listeners. This podcast is in no way a substitute for professional counseling. If you are in need of mental health services, please reach out to a professional in your area. This podcast may also cover sensitive topics or involve triggering words about death, loss, and trauma. Please use your own discretion when listening to this podcast and consider whether the topic being discussed is something you are ready to fully explore. Welcome to Therapy with My Mom, a podcast hosted by a mother and son who love each other very much.
Aw, hi, I'm Julie Barkowskis. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, a certified addictions counselor, as well as a somatic experiencing practitioner. I've been providing therapy on an outpatient basis in my private practice for over 20 years.
I'm Ryan Barkowskis, her son, and a millennial that was graced with having two parents who are both social workers.
This podcast is here to educate our listeners on the various aspects surrounding mental health.
Our guests will include individuals who are going to share personal stories on mental health struggles, as well as professionals who can shed light on the array of therapeutic approaches.
We hope you enjoy the journey with us. Welcome to our show.
Hi, Mom.
Hey, Ryan. I'm glad. What's up?
What's up? You doing anything right now? You busy?
My fractured foot is up in the air. That's what's up.
Oh my gosh. Poor thing.
So I'm mending a fractured bone in a foot to my listeners here. No get well wishes are necessary, guys. I don't need any of that.
It was fine. She was fighting crime. Like these things happen.
Well,
flying in.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was chasing after a criminal and I slipped when I was doing something heroic, right?
Absolutely.
But actually, if you heard that in the background, we have a lovely guest here with us today, Brandy Bowen, who is a neuropsychologist who also prescribes medication. And we've not had somebody on here to talk about that part of the lens of mental health. And I think this is going to be very exciting and enlightening for some of us. I was already just saying to Brandy that I was enlightened by a friend about this medication that he's taking for dementia. And I was like, oh my goodness, like I'm so uninformed. So I'm excited to have some conversations here for us to be enlightened as well as hopefully adding a lot more knowledge and information to our listeners. So as we start off here, Brandy will have to psychoanalyze us here as we're talking, and she can kind of make some assessments about our psychological states of mind, as well as our personalities. And
for sure.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Yeah.
Of course. Delighted.
Yeah. Ryan, he likes to do a little bit of a warm up. And so Ryan is going to kick this off today.
Yes. Us talking about the brain, I thought maybe like a brain teaser, maybe a riddle would be appropriate to kind of open things up. So this is less of a personal question and more of like a little test. Can you get this riddle right? So our question today. You see a boat filled with people. It has not sunk, but when you look again, you don't see a single person on the boat. Why?
See a boat with people. It has not sunk.
Filled with people. Yep.
But then you look again.
There's not a single person.
Because they all jumped in. They jumped.
Nope.
They jumped out of the boat.
Nope. They're all still on the boat.
Oh, well. I failed the test already.
What was your guess, Brandy? Did you have something?
I think I just became suddenly blind.
That a dock?
Nope. The boat's still just out there.
Did you hear what I said? I said I became suddenly blind.
Yeah, it was a personal thing. You're like, I closed my eyes. That was the problem. The trick is in one word. It's always like one word choice that gets you in these riddles. You don't see a single person.
Oh,
you see a bunch of
they're
people.
All married.
Oh, I like it.
Mm-hmm.
Clever.
That's the trick.
Very clever.
It was a couples only cruise.
Well, thank you so much for enlightening us on how unwitty I am. So
it's okay. It's still early-ish for all of us here. We're just warming up. That's the point.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. So as moving on to our exciting guest here, I would like to ask Brandy to talk a little bit about her professional knowledge as well as her background and a little bit about how she ended up getting into this field of work.
Sure. So I am a initially trained neuropsychologist. I predominantly do testing for a variety of different mental health disorders and cognitive disorders. But in when I was finishing up my doctorate training, I was approached by a colleague about doing psychopharmacology training. And so I ended up adding that on. And then I became what in Illinois is considered a prescribing psychologist. A couple of other states, they're not called the same thing. So I'm essentially a licensed psychologist, licensed prescribing psychologist, and a clinical neuropsychologist.
I don't hear about that too often or hear about that many people out in your field being able to do that.
I think right now in Illinois, there was under 20. I was the second, and I think we just licensed, we're in between like 18 and 25 of them. So,
wow.
Yeah.
It's a handful.
Yeah, it's not very many.
Yeah.
And there aren't very many states that do that. So,
mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a great combination. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a great combination because when you're doing the neurological part of it, that you can then also just segue right into the medication part of it for the people you're working with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It works out well for some people.
Now, was this field the end destination that you always had in mind? Was this a straight line that we took to getting here? Or was this double major in biological sciences also something that you were kind of like, I have a second option here?
So when I initially enrolled into college, my goal was actually to be a pediatrician. However, when I was right around the time that like my sophomore year transitioning into my junior year of college is when a lot of the changes started to happen with insurances and doctors were not allowed, you know, it wasn't as easy for physicians to spend as much time with patients. And that was concerning for me because I was not sure that that was a model that fit with how I preferred to do things. So I was talking to a couple of my professors about it. And one of my professors had kind of suggested the neuropsych route after I had finished for pre-med biology major. You have to have a couple of psych classes as electives to kind of count towards your major. And so when I finished those classes, they had suggested the neuropsych classes. And so after I took a couple of those, it ended up being a great fit because it matched a part of psychology that really resonated with me and it kept the biological piece. And so that's just what I kind of ended up going into.
That's super
that is
cool.
Awesome. So that's how you ended up in this field. Are you, how did you end up where you're at now? How did you end up in Illinois and doing neuropsych testing and doing, you know, working with people from that perspective?
So, I mean, like everybody else, when you go through your training, you're all over a variety of places. I actually grew up on a small farm in Illinois, outside of Oswego. And so throughout my education, the bulk of it has been in Illinois. A few of the schools have been out of state, but all of my training was in Illinois. My doctorate training was in the city. And I completed my neuropsych training at Rush. And by the time I had finished my neuropsych training and completed my internship and gotten ready to go on my postdoc, I was a little tired of city living. It's very interesting. If anybody's ever grown up in a rural area, my joke is that you spend your whole life trying to get out of the rural area. You spend a few years in the city, and then it's like, oh, I missed the quietness of the rural area. So I completed some additional training throughout a variety of hospitals. And when I started to do my pharmacology training, we really focused a lot on, in Illinois, how much of a divide there is between rural areas and more metropolitan areas with access. And then the other issue was there, up to 40% of the psychiatrists in Illinois are either in the process of retiring or going to retire within the next 5 years. They're at that age. And so that really hits rural areas. So after completing some additional working in Rockford, I had just decided that I would open up my own practice in a rural area to kind of fill the void in there.
Wow. What was your influence that, like, you growing up in a rural farm town, why was science and the brain so interesting to you?
I think in general, I've always just been a much more hands-on learner. And it kept my brain active. It's much more difficult for me to kind of just sit at a desk and not move around. And I just don't think like that, which is actually ironic because I come from a family of individuals who work in law. So I'm like the oddball. But my thinking just never flew that way. And biology was always, science was always just very interesting to me.
Yeah.
That's really exciting. I was wondering about now what you're doing. You know, can you tell us a little bit about the work you're doing now and how, you know, what age groups you're working with and what type of issues you've been addressing?
Sure. So what my day typically looks like now is I spend 1 week a month up in Rockford. I work for a clinic up there that I predominantly do neuropsychological testing, mainly for a lot of older individuals. And we get quite a few referrals from the OSF health system, but all of the health systems up there. And then the rest of the month I spend doing neuropsych testing or medication management for people in person in Sandwich at the Brain Clinic, or some medication management is done via Zoom, like tele appointments. There has definitely been an influx of testing, I would say, in the last few years. I think there's a variety of reasons that that's happened. When we look at individuals who are older, clearly, we have people living longer. Medicine has done wonders to help people, their body keep going. So just by default, the older people live, the higher their chances are of developing some type of dementia. We have, there's a variety of research that shows possible, processed foods and just different lifestyle things that occur that increase the chance of dementia. But there's definitely been an influx with after the COVID-19 pandemic, that has really increased, I think, the rates of testing, not necessarily always dementia, but has definitely increased the rates of testing because it changed people's schedule. And if you think about it, we survive on schedule, right? How many times have we driven home from work and we don't even remember driving home because it involves our rote memory? It's just our schedule is kind of ingrained in us. And when changes in schedule happen, it's very difficult to adapt to. And it becomes much more difficult when people are older. And if they can't adapt and they have difficulties, with socialization, with just completing general activities of daily living, then oftentimes that's a red flag, whether their physicians see it or family members or they themselves, and then they seek medical care. And somewhere in that process, they'll usually get referred for some type of evaluation, a neuropsychological evaluation, amongst other things, to kind of look and see what that diagnosis might be.
Okay.
Yeah, I definitely saw, like, with my elderly parents, I definitely saw even just the idea of isolation that played a role in their mental health. And you know, in addition to the other things that you mentioned.
Right.
Yeah.
And I would definitely say that there were several patients, probably 10 to 20% that came in that, you know, family members or physicians had thought that it was a dementia and it was really depression. It just hit them hard. But there were a good portion of individuals who came in and they were having symptoms or of the early symptoms of some form of dementia.
Yeah.
What are those early symptoms? What would you be seeing that kind of alerts you that you're like, oh, maybe that's what this is?
So part of it depends on the type of dementia. So dementia is kind of an umbrella term, much like cancer is an umbrella term. There are many different types of cancers. There's many different types of dementias. If you look at dementia and then you break it like as a circle up at the top and you break it down into two parts, there's cortical-related dementias and subcortical-related dementias. Subcortical-related dementias are much more, for lack of a simplifying it, the inner parts of the brain. So these are dementias that have to do with like your vascular nature. So people who have a history of strokes or heart attacks, diabetes, things like that, they're much more likely to have that type of dementia, or if they have Parkinson's or some type of movement issue. Cortical are more of what, and again, this is simplifying it some, but the outer cortex of the brain, which is much more like Alzheimer's type dementia, frontal temporal dementia, which has been in the news more because of Bruce Willis. And then Lewy body dementia can kind of fluctuate between the two. If it's more of a vascular type dementia, you'll see some issues with short-term memory, a lot of decision-making difficulties. For more of the cortical type dementias, you'll see some language difficulties, misplacing things, maybe accidentally leaving the stove on. And then as it progresses, then you'll see much more like mismanagement of money, getting lost, people getting up early in the morning, thinking that it's like 9, 10 o'clock, going outside, going for a drive, and that's when they'll often get lost or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's where a lot of times you'll see the silver alerts on like the tollways, or some people get alerts for them on their phone. It's because people, there's a disconnect between understanding time. And they'll wake up, it's 3 a.m, they go outside or going to go for a drive thinking that it's 11 a.m., they're going to go get their coffee. And it's not light out, so it's much harder to recognize where they're at, and they'll become lost.
Yeah, wow.
So it's interesting when you talk about that. I'm wondering, are the approaches to, how you say, slowing down the progression or increasing the likelihood of improving memory, would one be benefiting more than the other, or both?
So your cortical dementias, no matter what, they're going to progress. Some of them, there's steeper progressions than others, and that's dependent on a lot of different things. Medical health, education, family history, if there's a family history of Alzheimer's in a family, age of onset. But in general, there's a progression. Subcortical type dementia, sometimes it's a stepwise progression because, for example, vascular dementia can be very influenced by physical health, right? If you're not controlling your diabetes, the progression is going to be much quicker and much steeper than if you're controlling it and you can kind of plateau out. Mm-hmm. Now, from an approach standpoint, in terms of treatment, in general, treatments are very much the same between the two different types. We strongly encourage socialization. Socialization exercises every part of your brain. And your brain is very much like a muscle, right? There's truth to the idea, use it or lose it. When you think about interacting with other people, you have to think about your space between yourself and that person. You have to use the front part of your brain to follow the conversation and think about what you're going to say. You have to use your memory because often conversations involve things that have happened in the past. So it literally exercises every part of your brain, which is why the pandemic and the subsequent quarantine was so hard on people. They lost that that aspect
Yeah.
of things. Biology makes a difference. The more you take care of yourself medically, the better off you'll be. So that part of things is very, very truthful. The more surgeries that you have later in life, the more you increase the risk of things happening. The more medications that you're on, the better your mental health. But yes, there are medications that are associated with helping to slow down the progression. It will not stop it. It will not reverse it. But there are two different kind of types of medications. One impacts the plaques and tangles and acetylcholinesterase, and that medication is called Aricept or also donepezil. And there's a couple of different forms of that. And the other medication is an NMDA receptor, which impacts the excitatory neurotransmitters, and that medication is called Namenda. Some doctors prefer to start one over the other, depending on what's going on. So sometimes you'll see Namenda start more with vascular issues and Aricept start more with like Alzheimer's. But oftentimes, once you see one's not working as well, they will add on the other medication. Mm-hmm. And so they'll kind of just double it up.
So what is the medication helping with? Is it really just slowing the process? Is dementia just something that you have to manage and try to slow?
Correct. It is just going to hopefully slow it down. How well it slows it down is really dependent on the person. When I see patients, I tell them it's a crapshoot. 50% of people it helps with, 50% it doesn't. There's no way to know. But in general, most people don't have a lot of side effects with the medication. So you'll see most people, it's tried on them. It works a little bit better in the earlier stages rather than the later. But that's essentially what the goal is that we're going to try to hopefully slow it down. But that's all we can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm wondering, when you said something about like the different types that can happen, you know, and again, I'm having connections with number of people that are, you know, older than me. And I have, you know, discovered one person whose onset just seemed to happen pretty quickly. And then the progression happened much more quicker than, you know, someone else that maybe is like slowly progressing. And, you know, so there could be a variety of variations in that. Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah, the level of progression and how quickly it goes can be very, very dependent on a lot of different things.
Okay, so that's
not
unusual.
Can you describe onset for me? Like, I feel like I've heard like onset dementia or something. Like, what does onset mean?
So onset, in layman's terms, means that there has been a progression from a mild cognitive impairment, which is just a little bit more than age appropriate, and it has now turned into essentially the onset of a full-blown dementia. It's not unusual for people to have cognitive impairments the older that they get. When it becomes a little bit more than age appropriate, so there's a little bit more difficulties with learning electronics or remembering how to use the remote control or something like that, then it's a mild cognitive impairment. It's just a little bit more than it should be, but it's not impacting a lot of different things. Once it starts to impact multiple cognitive domains and much more consistently, that has now become the onset of dementia. It is no longer a mild situation.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
So almost like going from pre-diabetes to diabetes.
Okay. Gotcha. Once it passes a threshold. I would love to steer this towards some of the other things I know that you also deal with and kind of focus on. I saw on your bio, you have also like done some study and lectures on concussions and brain damage in that way. What was the motivation behind kind of going the route of brain damage?
So one of the big reasons that we've kind of talked more about concussions, and I approach it a little bit differently than some of my colleagues, just in terms of what we prefer to focus on, is obviously we're learning more about concussions. We're learning more about CTE, the impact of the brain getting jiggled around in our head. We're learning more about that. We're becoming more aware of it. We're trying to do more testing for it. But what good is testing later on if we don't have a baseline? So one of the points of the different things that I've spoken about is that, and I realize that this would be somewhat difficult to do with insurance and a variety of other things, is that I feel that when kids graduate from high school, one of the requirements to graduate should be just a baseline cognitive evaluation, a basic IQ test, a basic test of, you know, memory, visual spatial skills, attention, so that we have a baseline. So 5 years later, 10 years later, 30 years later, we have that baseline that we can measure up against in case something does happen. And not just related to concussions. Yes, we are learning more about concussions, but we are also having an influx of individuals having strokes and heart attacks much earlier in life. And those things can impact how well the brain works, particularly the frontal lobe. And how can we measure how impaired somebody is if we do not have a good baseline? So that's one of the points of the lectures that I've given, and it started with concussions, was that that should be something that we should really look into doing for society, is to have some way to test everybody to get that baseline.
Yeah, that makes sense. Are you a football fan, Brandy?
I am.
Yeah, I was wondering if that was connected at all, that being, something that has been a major focus of taking care of our players and all the brain injuries that they can sustain.
Right. Yeah. Right. And especially the players who are older now, because obviously there's differences in equipment. But there's so much more to be explored with that, not just in terms of whether or not, the physiological impact has caused damage, but then also lifestyle. There is a lot to be said for athletes going from the top of their game to retiring, and then in a lot of ways becoming an average person, and how well they can adapt to that, and then what that does to mental health, which then does to the brain. There's a lot that needs to be explored, but we definitely are learning more and more about
it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, I think about just the idea of being so physically active, and if you don't stay physically active, how that changes what's happening for you as well.
Sure.
And you know, working on like head injury or brain damage and so forth and so on, so let's say someone suffers brain damage from an aneurysm or brain surgery, are there certain things that can be done to help or assist with that, or what's their options there?
So typically they'll go to rehab. Rehab is a process, depending on how they qualify, what insurance covers. There's inpatient rehab, outpatient rehab, in-home rehab. But the old idea was that your first year to 2 years, you made all the gains that you were going to make, and then that was it. And that's why you would see therapies be discontinued, people essentially kind of be thrown by the wayside. What's been recovered's been recovered, and that's it. And we've learned much more about the brain, that essentially our brain is trying to rewire itself and trying to continue to adapt to parts of it that are atrophying till the day that we die. So the more we keep people active, whether it's in therapies or day programming or something like that, the better off that they will be. But there is no, after obviously insurance and just in general, there's a discharge process once physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, cognitive therapies are used up, for lack of a better term. But the healing process does not stop there.
Well, that's encouraging news for some people who told, hey, it's just going to, whatever you get in a year is it, as opposed to, no, that's not true. So I'm glad to hear that. And so then you also work around the subject of attention deficit and hyperactivity disorders as well. Do you do some psych testing in that area with kids, or maybe there's even other areas that you address with the younger population?
Yeah. So we get a lot of referrals for ADHD learning disorders. Right now, autism is kind of a hot topic, especially with like social media and stuff. So we'll get a lot of referrals for that. It's a very, very common thing. I think social media brings more attention to it. Social media does not help some of the symptoms for things. So it definitely has led to an influx. I would say probably 5 cases a week at least that have to do with some type of attention or is there a possible autism spectrum disorder going on.
Now, are you involved in any of the neurofeedback treatments or approaches that happen, or is that something that's done in the clinic you're at, or?
No, we don't do that. That's the specialized mm-hmm. training. The closest clinic I'm aware of that does that is a clinic in Naperville. Mm-hmm. There is also a gentleman up in the Oak Brook area who does mm-hmm. brain mapping and brain imaging yeah. too.
Yeah, actually, I'm aware of one clinic in St. Charles as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
that,
cool.
That does it as well. Yeah.
It's a wonderful way to kind of add in treatment.
Yeah, definitely. Some people have reported like they have had some improvement in memory or they mm-hmm. actually feel like some way that they've helped them deal with like symptoms that they can't explain, like why their brain is fainting or, you know, whatever that might be. So, yeah.
Yeah, that fatigue level.
Yeah.
On the subject of ADD and ADHD, I'm here today wondering what's a guy got to do to get a diagnosis? I think this has always been something we've joked about being like Ryan has a little bit of like attention deficit disorder. I never got a diagnosis. I've never been medicated for anything. And so I've always wondered if I might hit any of the criteria. I think I sometimes claim that as something, you know, maybe everyone has a little bit of it, but not to the level of being diagnosed with it. I'm not sure.
So the criteria is actually in the process of being changed again because of the pandemic. So with the pandemic and the influx of online treatment options being there was a jump in people being diagnosed through like questionnaires and just kind of basic checklists. And then subsequently being prescribed medications, which is often stimulants. And that has helped lead to one of the reasons that there's a shortage right now in Adderall and some of the other medications that we typically use for treating an attention deficit disorder. So it appears that one of the things that the government and some of the medical organizations are kind of pushing towards is that a neuropsychological evaluation be done to provide a more thorough assessment of symptoms and make sure that ADHD is a correct diagnosis. Because for many disorders, if you look at the DSM or if you look at symptoms on a checklist, there's a lot of overlapping symptoms between different disorders. PTSD and ADHD have a lot of overlapping symptoms, for example. And if I just use a checklist and I don't use standardized normative data out of an assessment, it can be very easy to misdiagnose things. And that can lead to a whole host of problems. Whether the medication is beneficial or not, sometimes we're not treating the underlying disorder. There's not a lot of, there could be exacerbations of symptoms. It just really kind of depends. So your best bet from this point going forward now is for a lot of people to seek out a neuropsychological evaluation with somebody who's trained in it. I always suggest that people see a neuropsychologist because it is extra training. It's about 2 to 4 years of extra training past Wow. what a typical clinical psychologist has. And Yeah. having that document that supports an ADHD diagnosis makes it much easier for you to get medical treatment. And really guides therapy as well.
Now, are you doing any brain scans? Are you just like, is it a questionnaire mm-hmm. and kind of just some like random tests? Am I using objects? Like, what am I actually doing?
For a neuropsych test? So everybody kind of differs, but they're essentially standardized tests that are almost like an example of a standardized test is an ACT. It is not
awful.
invasive like an MRI or a brain scan or anything like that, but essentially you'll get an IQ test. You get a test that looks at academic abilities, tests that look at executive functioning, attention, visual, spatial skills, and then questionnaires that will look at aspects of anxiety and personalities functioning and things like that. And then all of those different assessments, which can take, depending on the person that you go to, anywhere from 3 to 16 hours.
Wow.
And then they analyze all of those results and put it together in a report. And then that report you go through gives the diagnosis and will also give the recommendations.
Okay.
I think there's a lot to be said about having, you know, not just a simple test, like, you know, Ryan, I took you in one time to see a psychologist. She
I
said that
remember.
you had some mild symptoms, but nothing significant to be worried about. And so we went home and we just used other methods and other approaches to help you. And, but I can think about stories I've heard where someone maybe is misdiagnosed with Asperger's and really it's PTSD. And, or like you said, someone misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder and it's really PTSD. And so I can see why it would be real important to make sure that there is psychological or neuropsychological testing done. I know at one point it was done so often when I started off in this career, and it was just done. And then all of a sudden it seemed like insurance really reined it back. Like it really, insurance stopped saying, well, this is not a necessary form of treatment. And, you know, this is only should be done when, you know, as an exception. So that makes me really curious about whether or not we could start swinging back to, hey, insurance companies, you could actually save money if we actually got the right diagnosis and we're treating this person properly, rather than they're being treated for who knows a number of years before someone says this isn't working.
Correct. Or even not being treated and then subsequently self-medicating or having a whole host of other problems.
Mm-hmm. Right. So Ryan, did you get any help on recognizing whether or not you suffer from attention deficit disorder? Do you need other information to help you with this?
Yeah, I think the insight, like you reminding me that I saw a psychologist and they said I had mild symptoms, that like I feel like that checks out. Like I know, like I'm able to do things I need to. I just have such a hard time getting them started. Like I had good test scores and that was great, but like it doesn't mean I hold attention well for other things that I just don't enjoy.
Right. Yeah, I just employed more useful tools that I knew I could encourage for you to help you deal with this. And then also just like we were talking about before, like just making sure that nutritionally your brain was getting all the right nutrients to help it function as well as it could too. Mm-hmm. And because you were doing so well in school, even though it was still stressful on you, it wasn't showing up like you were having academic problems in school. And so we didn't meet this criteria of like, oh, that's going to, you know, we really need to do something because it's interfering with your education. It did not appear. Now, maybe you would have been doing even better. I don't know. I mean, after all, but you were doing
yeah,
so well.
Aced
I mean,
ACT. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it would have gone like perfect or something on the ACT, but no. So that's the context. I mean, you were already in gifted classes. I mean, and that's part of it too, is I don't know what your thoughts are here, Brandy, but I wonder too that, you know, if you're gifted, sometimes you're not getting enough stimuli. It is boring. And there's another part of that that affects whether or not you're attending to it or paying attention to it.
Sure. And in general, I think too, most people who are gifted, attention is going to always be a personal weakness for them. Attention and processing speed, just because they have so much going on in their head. And so that is, you know, just always going to be something that is more difficult for them, that they are probably going to show borderline, if not mild symptoms of ADHD. And then it kind of just becomes, well, what is the goals of intervention? What kind of interventions are we really looking at? So knowing that that is something that's going to be a personal weakness, it comes down to then, you know, how do we view interventions? Do we view them as more holistic, more pharmacology based? Where are those decisions coming from? Why are they coming from that way? And it's kind of what we're going to do about that going forward, especially with society.
So how can I treat myself if I don't have medication? What should I be doing to aid my mild symptoms?
Well, you're also, if you're gifted, honey, then we're looking at that other piece, right? I mean, we're dealing with whether or not, because I'll give you, if it's all right, I'll interrupt here for a second. I'm not expert. I'm not expert. I'm the mom expert.
Nor am I.
I'm the mom
expert. Moms are much better experts.
What I was going to say is just that when you were trying to pay attention in class, I remember telling you how I tried to pay attention in college. And I said, I found something that would help me pay attention to keep it interesting because it was just not interesting. And I remember you saying finding irony and finding
humor and
double
things,
meanings and humor, that's how you were able to bring yourself to stay engaged and in paying attention. So that was one of the approaches I saw that you were able to employ, which was using your own creative mind to come up with a solution of how to stay involved and make it more interesting to you.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And I've always just wanted like things to fidget with. Otherwise, like I just, the sitting still is a hard thing. I would like pick the dirt out of my shoes. I would play with Rubik's cubes. Like I've always just wanted something to do with my hands or be able to doodle while I like just sitting and staring at a lecture can be really difficult.
Right.
So, I mean, that has worked for me. I've gotten by.
So, Brandy, did you have something else that you would throw out about tools or techniques?
I think that those are very good things. I mean, right, you got to make it fun. Active listening, like learning how to active listen is a really big thing in today's world. We spend so much time doing 1,000 things at once that we're not necessarily present in anything. And so, you know, in some situations that's beneficial, right? Much like Ryan was saying, I needed to doodle to pay attention in lecture. But sometimes that's not always the greatest way to have a one-on-one conversation with people. So it's kind of just really learning to practice different methods and which ones are the most socially appropriate, most beneficial for different situations and kind of going from there. Other ones are like exercise is a great natural way to treat it. Coffee can be for some people. But really it's, I think it comes very much down to, especially in today's world, just kind of teaching people in more one-on-one situations, in work situations, to just slow down, be active in what you're doing, really present so that you're making sure you don't miss things, you're not making careless mistakes, things like that.
So you being a neuropsychologist informed about the brain, I am curious, and I've asked this question to some of our experts, about your take on different substances that are becoming more legal and also being used maybe in the field of repairing the brain. So specifically the use of medical marijuana or recreational and how that's affecting kids and adults. And psychoactive substances, if you see positives or negatives to both of those.
So when we look at kids, and we'll say a non-medically complicated case, so like no history of seizure disorders or anything like that, we do know that marijuana is just anything, alcohol, cigarettes, any other kind of illicit substances, it's just not great because the frontal lobe is still developing and that is going to really impact the frontal lobe's development. It's going to make it not develop as well physiologically, neurochemically. It increases the risks of mental health issues and more major mental health issues like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. It increases the risk of having like dysexecutive functioning, short-term memory issues. So until that frontal lobe is developed, which depending on the person is somewhere between 22 and 29 years old, it's not the greatest thing. And obviously below 18 and below, it's really not, because the bulk of the growing is happening then. After that, so let's say the frontal lobe is fully developed. After that, in terms of short term, there are some benefits to it. There are some cons to it, at least with medical marijuana, right? So like we do know that it increases the risk of something called rebound anxiety and rebound depression, which essentially means that when it wears off, the symptoms are more likely to come back and come back more significantly. There are suggestions of, like I said, increased risks of bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, things like that. Longitudinally, we just do not know. For anyone to tell you that we know would not be an accurate statement. We are just now learning that the Valium and the benzodiazepines that we pushed in the 70s and the 80s could be correlated with dementia later in life. They could not be, but they could. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we just don't know enough yet. When we take that, and then we need to look at balancing out quality of life for people who have chronic pain or cancer or things like that. Those are very different things. The other issue that comes is potency. At the end of the day, marijuana today is not the same as marijuana in the 60s. It's much more potent. It's much more harder on the body. And those kinds of things need to be considered, whether it's bought on the street or it's bought from a dispensary. The field is just now opening up to more of the the NMDA, the ecstasy, things like that. So again, we don't know. Some of the early studies coming out say that it can be very beneficial for PTSD. How much is too much? What the long-lasting effects are, both positive and negative. We're still learning. Science is an evolving field. So, you know, the best that we can tell patients is that do things safely, do things smartly, but understand that we can't guide you one way or another.
Yeah.
You know, what I think about is when you're taking a substance, let's say Valium or marijuana, that the brain is learning to rely on that substance. I'm a substance abuse counselor, so I've worked on this area even with in terms of alcohol, and we call it state dependent learning. And all of a sudden you remove that substance, and that brain, that nervous system, doesn't still know how to deal with things because it was in a totally different state of mind. And so that learning edge or all those skills that person could have developed, you know, they didn't learn them. Even if they were because they were under the influence of this other chemical. So, you know, sometimes people, I feel badly because the media and a lot of things are out in the world are not really telling people the whole picture. They're giving, you know, little tidbits of things. Mm-hmm. So,
And people themselves are giving little tidbits of things, TikTok, all those, you know, and it's just not as informed as we would like it to be.
And everyone has their own chemistry. Like, it can affect some people really positively, and other people, they're like, it gives me crippling anxiety and I can't do it. And I'm like, okay, good, then don't do it. Like, do what's right for your body.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I look at someone with bipolar disorder who walks in and is normal because they use marijuana, and they are, unbeknownst to them, really self-medicating. That they're like, I'm normal when I use marijuana. And I'm like, there's got to be something else going on in that brain for you to be normal when you're using, you know, so that there's other parts of that, you know, we don't always know or recognize.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I also just kind of wanted to jokingly ask a question. As we talked about standardized testing, and we did talk about the ACT, what were our ACT scores?
Mine was terrible.
Do you remember it?
Yeah. In fact, you know, I was never given ACT prep. Yeah. I wasn't advised on how I should take the test.
Oh,
and
sure.
so I actually, I took it once. That's how I did. I took the test, didn't even know that I should fill it all out. So I was taking, I didn't know, I didn't even know about
like timing. Just fill in the bubbles.
Where they tell you, you might as well guess, like, yeah, you will be penalized.
Yeah, I didn't even know about the time wise that I should worry about the time. I mean, I was totally not prepared. So I didn't answer half of the, I was like probably one fourth of the test I did not complete.
Wow. Wow.
But I came out with a 21.
Okay.
And I was the fourth in my class.
Wow.
Out of 135 people, I was number four. That's so I wasn't good. I wasn't a dummy. I just was not, I wasn't given that. And so the college saw that I was ranked four and I had good grades.
Yeah, that's great. Just, that helps.
Yeah.
I was going to make a joke. I was like, I'll have 13 people in your class, right? But 100, 130 is pretty good.
It's so bad.
It's a small town, okay? Rural areas.
Yeah, it was just like a little bitty bitty town.
Yeah, and you're like, it was me and the sheep, and they didn't even put their names on the test, so I looked really good.
So you know, do you remember your score, Ryan?
I do, yes. Mm-hmm. I got 31.
Yeah, you were.
Look at you go.
So should we ask Brandy? Yeah. Does Brandy want to share?
Do you remember yours?
You're more than welcome to. I have no clue what my score was, but I can tell you that my joke with my family was is that I probably only got points for putting my name on. I was never a good test taker. I was the same way. I did very well in school. I was ranked very high in my class, but tests were never my thing.
And I think that's partly because I'm analytical, that's partly being analytical. That, you know, we take our time to analyze and think about something as opposed to, like, you know, just look at, you know, answering that question and boom, 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 boom. So,
like, it's not something that, like, I do. Obviously, I like to brag about it a little bit because I did get a pretty good score. What's most important to me is the fact that I beat my brother by 1 point. And that's all that really matters, because he got a 30 and I got a 31.
I think that is all that matters.
Yeah. Being the younger brother, I'm like, hey, well, you know, smarter.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Anytime you could feel like you did anything better than your older sibling, you felt a little more proud of yourself, right?
Which is countless times, really, like more than I can list right now. But, you know, this is just one example.
Oh, just one of a few. Yeah.
Of many dozens.
He has the list hiding in his back pocket. He'll show it to you before Christmas.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's a separate episode.
He'll have a conversation with you about how many things he knows better and does better than you.
So. Yeah, join us on our next episode where we talk about humility and that science.
Sibling rivalry.
That's a good one. Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks for letting us explore that a little bit. At least that will count as our little trivia question today. Our final question is something that we like to kind of use as a wrap up of maybe some things that you've learned and taught us today, and we can share with the audience on the way out. And that is, if you have a mantra, if you have a philosophy, like a short phrase or just a couple words, anything like that, that you kind of find yourself coming back to.
Yes, but it's not short.
That's okay.
I mean, like, which would probably make sense now after hearing me talk, that nothing's really short.
Not even that long-winded. Yeah,
so, yes, and I'm more than happy to share that. However, to make sure that I get it right, is it okay if I look it up?
You may.
Sure, you can do that. And also, possibly mentioning resources as well, and anything else that might be helpful for our listeners.
When you're looking at different resources about things, there are different ways to kind of look at this. For more of the neuropsych testing, there are a variety of organizations like the American Academy of Clinical Neuropsychology, most of the major universities. Any of the neuropsychologists on their website, like I even listed on my website what neuropsychology means, where it can be beneficial, things like that. I do think that physicians are getting much more understanding and educated about it, so they're also a resource. But if you're in the muck of everything, books, always a great way to kind of learn more information. Online articles by professionals, not PAP psychology, but support groups are great, great places for people to go, especially if they're a caregiver or the loved one is someone who suffers from an autism spectrum disorder, severe ADHD, mild ADHD, some form of dementia. They are just very, very beneficial. When it comes to medication, I really do think that, or at least the approach that I use with my patients is that it has to be very collaborative. And so when people come in and we kind of talk about what's going on, I provide them with some different ideas about medications that I would suggest based on their symptoms, and that they go home and they kind of talk to, you know, family members. Maybe there's a family member that's on something that they never would have even known. I know that they're going to Google. And, you know, WebMD and all those things can be very beneficial, but I always ask that we talk about it. Because I realize that the internet is going to have a plethora of different sources and different things that people are going to read. And some of it is very helpful. But I think that in general, those types of things like should always be a collaborative situation. Always talk to everybody about that. But I do think that in today's world, support groups are very, very beneficial.
Yeah, it kind of TikTok fits with that is idea.
I just said TikTok is not one.
It is not. It's not a support group.
No.
Good. Glad we said it.
Yeah, I was just going to say that goes back to the what's good for the brain is that we're socially interacting. So that makes a sense too. Yeah.
And I tell families all the time that support groups are wonderful because they'll think of things that I would never even have thought of that, you know, are going to be very, very good and, you know, can work with somebody and much better than I ever would have.
Right. Some practical things that everybody passes on to one another. So, yeah. So have we gotten to our mantra?
Yeah. I do have it. Okay. So it's from Ralph Waldo Emerson. So I think that his quote that I'm going to read is something that's really represented my life and I hope most people's lives. So it is, to laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to leave the world a better place, to know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived. This is to have succeeded. And that's something that I try to live my life by. I have anybody who comes into my office, there's a poster of that quote on my hallway. So
nice.
I love that. That's beautiful.
Love the act of sharing it. Like that's something that we love to do. I do it with my tattoos. We, you know, we do it with posters and things that we display. That way you can share that with somebody else. And that's always the best way to do it.
Very nice. Well, I have to tell you, I've learned a lot. I so appreciate you being on with us and giving us all this wealth of information. And I feel like I have things I can share with people I know, not only just my clients, but just, you know, family and friends who can benefit from this information. So I appreciate so much for you taking the time to give us all this. And, you know, maybe it might help Ryan a little bit.
Maybe a little bit. Yeah.
Maybe a little bit.
Yeah. I so appreciate like your certainty and your confidence in all these different subjects. Your eagerness and your mission to like help serve these rural areas. And I'm always so impressed when someone is just so interested in their subject, is committed to it. And I see that with you, and I've so appreciated that passion in this conversation. So thank you for all of that.
No, thank you guys. Thank you guys so much for creating this kind of platform to kind of help get the word out, educate people, spread the idea of healthy mental health and psychological and psychiatric understanding, and not making it as much of a situation where people are getting their information off of social media and more pop psychology. So I appreciate you guys and all that you're doing. So thank you guys so, so much.
Absolutely.
Well, you take care. And, you know, I now know another resource out there, because I'm in Yorkville and Aurora. So I'm looking forward to the fact that I now have another resource to give to other people as well.
Me
so.
too. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Love that. Professional connections.
Yeah. Right? Well, you take
well, thank
care.
Thank you again, Brandy. Enjoy
thank
the rest
you.
Of your week and your weekend. And hopefully we'll talk to you again another time.
Sounds great. Thank you guys so much. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
I don't know about you, but I think about so many different people I know that this information, I'm like,
yeah,
I'm like, I knew this stuff, but I didn't know as much as I would have liked to have known. And I feel like I've just added more to my,
yeah,
you know, my own base here to kind of go, okay, here's some more things we can offer to people. So,
yeah, I feel good about my diagnosis or lack of diagnosis now. I think I'm comfortable with that. I just feel, yeah, I feel like a little bit more informed.
Well, you could relate to this. I mean, I have all these people who are older than me. So, except that you know, you're seeing people, you know, someday your dad and I, you're going to have to look at that and go, oh, I wonder if they got a little bit of dementia going on.
You guys are doing well, though, so far. I don't see any signs of early onset dementia. So far, so good. I'll be running some tests, you know, just to be sure. What are you pointing at? What you doing?
Yeah, well, I recently was told by a family member that their loved one had a stroke and they didn't know it. And but this person does have some issues around, like, you know, what is it called, diabetes number two or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
So
yep.
That type two. There you go. Yeah. Smart kid. So, but yeah, I feel like I just glad to have more opportunity to share this and spread the word to people so that they have an additional resource to kind of figure out what they need and how to get help. And so that I'm real grateful for.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So other than that, I'm going to try to keep my brain as active and as, you know, healthy as possible so that I can, you know, score a little higher next time.
It's okay. You don't need to retake the ACG at this point. I think it's okay.
I'm kidding.
I think it's okay. Yeah, no. What we can do is...
I have to reflect. I'm sorry. I have to reflect that if I didn't answer all the questions, I still scored 21. Maybe I would have got a better score if I didn't know it all.
It was like, it's made to be something so important. And then like it helped me get a scholarship. But like past that, it's just something I used to pick up ladies. Like it wasn't anything else. Can you imagine?
I doubt if anybody would have cared to be like, hey, my ACT score is this.
Yeah, I went to a liberal arts school. No one cared about the ACT score. No one cared.
Yeah.
But no, we're going to continue to take care of ourselves through all the methods that Dr. Bowen suggested. Exercise, socialization is my preferred way. Love socializing. So I loved that reminder that, you know, that uses all the parts of our brain. It's like one of the most healthy things to do. So that's going to be what I'm going to do. I'm going to go out and socialize right now.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, and this is socialization right here. Did you realize that when you said you're going to go socialize right now?
I guess. I thought this was like a treatment for you. Like, I feel like I'm the one helping you here.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Tills, yeah, it's really taxing for me to be here, like explaining things to you, helping you find the words. Yeah.
I hope the audience knows that we really don't have an issue here.
Like busting your chops a little bit. I can't help it. It's fun. It's love. That's what
good
it
thing
is.
I don't. Yeah. And I don't believe anything you just said, but that's okay.
Except the last part that I love you.
Aw. I love you too, babies.
Very good. We appreciate you all. Thank you guys for listening. Please take care of yourselves this week and the next week and all the weeks henceforth. And we will talk to you guys very soon.
Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to Therapy with My Mom. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can best support us by reviewing and downloading the episode on whatever platform you listen on. Tell your family and loved ones about the show, and don't forget to follow and engage with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Therapy with My Mom. You can also email us at therapywithmymom@gmail.com with any topic suggestions or stories you might want to have shared on the show.
Great job, Ryan.
Thanks, Mom.